A are Representative Thompson, Representative Laban, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. I'd also like to thank Senator Keel for joining us today. This morning, we will hear an introduction of House Bill 55, Peace Officer Firefighter Retire Benefits, by Representative Josephson. Representative, welcome. If you and your staff would please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chairman Merrick. Good morning, everybody. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 17 in Anchorage.
Elise Thornburg, staff to Representative Josephson.
So, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the Finance Committee, we have before us today House Bill 55, and I'm grateful for you calendaring it. I think this is an historic opportunity for this committee and for the 32nd legislature to do something really positive for our public employees, for our first responder public employees. In Alaska, there are about 44,000 active public employees. These are people that make the wheels of government function so that we can have peace, our roads cleared, our trash removed, our children educated, and make the economy and the wheels of the economy run. From 1961 to 2005, these workers were eligible for a defined benefit. This is the term used for what I call an old school pension, something you could rely on and that would be there until you die. After 2005, the eligibility for new employees to receive a defined benefit was permanently closed, and it's remained closed for 16 years. Instead, public employees receive a defined, new ones receive a defined contribution, commonly called a 401k or a 403a. These benefits become portable at the time of vesting, usually in 5 years, and that is a critical part of the problem. It's great to be vested, but it's the power of vesting. Alaska went into a period of retrenchment because of an unfunded liability. And through a combination of bad actuarial advice and our own lack of vigilance, the unfunded liability was there but not really known until the mid-decade of the aughts, say 2004 or 5. At its height, that unfunded liability was $11 billion. Thankfully, it's now about $5 billion. The retrenchment, and I think we swung the pendulum too far, came at a cost. It was a very heavy cost. The cost is the hollowing out of the workforce, and this must be true across the workforce. So what you see is you see older people, probably in their late 40s, 50s, 60s, and you see the young, late teens, 20s, and the middle group are gone. Not totally gone, of course not, but they're gone, and you'll hear testimony about that. They've gone to other states because they have skills, and they have shopped, and they've seen that they can do better elsewhere, and they don't want to leave, and they'll tell you that. They don't want to leave, but they're leaving. There is a lack of ability to compete in the current system. There's a lack of ability to hire in the current system. We lose significant training revenue, especially for our first responders. And you will hear testimony. It won't be argued. It won't be contested. You'll hear numbers ranging from about $90,000 to about $200,000 to train these individuals, paramedics, fire, police, troopers, corrections officers. Some of that money, by the way, remember that those dollars are borne by the state and the local governments. They fund that training. And when it leaves to Washington or Colorado or Wisconsin, it takes the training with it in a perfectly lawful and competitive way. So what we do is we train up these folks, and you may wonder, how can it be so expensive? Many of them return to get additional certification. They're firefighters who go back to get paramedic certification, for example. There's a massive disruption to the quality of life of the workforce we have. And I just met with the commissioner designee of DPS an hour ago, and he reminded me of something that is so obvious, but I'd forgotten. And that is, when we can't hire replacement workers at the rate we need to, there are real world impacts of that. Because, for example, he told the Tribal Committee, Special Committee on Tribal Affairs, last week, that they had a class of 36 troopers. That sounds pretty good. Well, 33 left, not those exact 33 of 36, but 33 others left. So they're at a positive 3, and you can see the problem. And I would note that our new commissioner designee has highlighted this issue twice, in tribal affairs and then in judiciary, the need for a defined benefit for our first responders. This bill would ask that a group of about, we can fine-tune the numbers, but it's going to be in the range of 3,000. Some of them already have a defined benefit, so we're not taking a risk with that group. We're talking about a cohort of about 3,000 of the 44,000 I mentioned. So in the area of risk, and you're going to see that this bill is not risky in any event, but we've already reduced the risk because we're talking about this cohort. That this is a risk worth taking, but to get to where you want to go, you have to allow for a new defined benefit. The risk is small. I would note that the one fiscal note that we have so far identifies that we're one of the only states without defined benefits for our public safety employees. I want to highlight just a few things, and I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Soren Burke, and she'll run through a PowerPoint. What makes this bill low risk is that it has cost-saving features. The first one is, and this doesn't come without some pain, co-chairs, members of the committee, but members will only receive a health reimbursement account on retirement. This is not going to generally prove adequate between the period of retirement and Medicare eligibility. But they're willing to do that because, understand, this is written by and for these members. Of course, I'm the author of it. Now you're the author of it. But it's their idea. It's been fine-tuned by them by looking at other states and other models. But they're willing to give on the health reimbursement issue. The other thing is it fixes the age of retirement at 55, so they can't draw it as soon. And for a public safety worker, their bodies wear down, and they may retire in their early 40s. They're going to have to likely find other work to fill the gap before they can actually receive a pension. They'll need to do 20 years of service, typically. They can do much less if they wait to age 60. Another cost-saving feature is that instead of a high 3, they will do a high 5. This matters because the testimony has been that it's very hard to go to the North Slope for 5 years and try to seek a high 5 due to a cost of living adjustment. And speaking of cost of living adjustments, there's no COLA here. So that's the 10% that workers get if they're in a previous defined benefit. That is not part of this plan. There are also plan asset enhancement adjustments. The employee contributions can be increased where the actuary finds that the plan is beneath 90% solvency. Now, 90% solvency is regarded as really solvent. That's really pretty good. As I'm reminded yesterday that Representative Rasmussen talked about 60% being barely passing. Well, 90% is an A-minus, and you should think of it that way. The bill also has the ability for the ARM board to say, we are withholding the post-retirement pension adjustment. That's essentially an inflation adjuster. So the effect of that is literally what you got last month in your pension could be smaller the next month. These stakeholders, these responders, first responders, are willing to suffer that to get the plan benefit that they seek here. And understand, this is selfless for many of them, right? Sure, they want a defined benefit, but they're looking to stop the hollowing out of their workforce. The last thing I'll say, just two other comments. There is a lot of desire, and I share this desire, to return to a defined benefit for all public employees. And I can tell you, as the grandson of the man who founded AFSCME in 1932 and became its president in 1936 and held the presidency for 30 years, Arnold Zander, who is in the Labor's Hall of Fame, and I was pleased to be in Detroit in 1997 to see my grandfather posthumously inducted into the Hall of Fame with people like John L. Lewis and Franklin Roosevelt and some of the great labor people in history. So I share that interest. But I think the public will understand that first responders are unique. And the legislature got burned in 2005. It felt burned. And I think we need to establish, this isn't just a stepping stone. This bill stands on its own. But I think the legislature is entitled to see how this plan works. Is it going to really be solvent the way our own state retirement officials say it will be? And then to look in the out years at other options. I think the stars are aligned. I think we have bipartisan support. And I appreciate the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I would like the record to reflect at 9:12 a.m. we were joined by Representative Rasmussen. Ms. Soren-Burk.
Good morning, Co-Chair Merrick, members of the committee. For the record, Elise Soren-Burk. I will try to be fairly brief with my presentation, since we do have a couple other presenters online as well who will go into some of the more technical details of the actuarial analysis and the cost of training. So I'll start by going through a sectional analysis of the bill. Up on the screen, you will see the sections that do major things in the bill. It is quite lengthy, however, these sections that you see in front of you are the main triggers that Representative Josephson was referring to previously that make this plan cost effective and make it work. So section one of the bill relates to the powers and duties of the Alaska Retirement Management ARM Board, adding duties to account for appropriate employer contributions in the new tier, and allows them to determine the amount of the monthly employer contribution under the new subsection 39.35.255I for the new defined benefit plan. Section 2 amends AS 37.10.220B regarding the powers and duties of the ARM Board and gives them the ability to adjust the post-retirement pension adjustment amounts and the employer contribution rate. Section 3 adds definitions for peace officer and firefighter to the existing ARM Board statutes, and these are the definitions used in the existing PERS defined benefits section. Section 4 adds the new HRA medical benefits section established in Section 29 of this bill to the list of retiree medical benefits that the Department of Administration has the power to procure group insurance for. Section 5 relates to the defined benefit retiree trust fund established in AS 39.30.097A and adds the new 39.35.537, which will be talked about later in the bill, which is the Peace Officer Firefighter HRA health plan, to the list of medical benefit programs that the Department of Administration Commissioner is authorized to pre-fund. Section 6 is the same thing as that, but it relates to the defined contribution retiree health care trust. Section 7 makes a revisor's type technical change, using a new preferred term referring to the state retirement system. Sections 8 through 11 all add 39.35.537, that's the new tier's medical benefit, to existing HRA statutes. Section 8 relates to terminated employees and notes that the employee would lose their right to their contribution to the HRA if they terminate their employment prior to meeting eligibility requirements. And this is in line with what happens under Tier 4 HRAs. Section 9 makes the new plan eligible for reimbursements from the HRA. Section 10 allows the administrators to deduct the cost of monthly reimbursement. Section 11 deals with the definition of eligible persons found in AS 39.30.495, and that's the section containing all of the definitions for the HRA statutes. Section 12 amends AS 39.35.095, which lays out the applicability of the defined benefit retirement plan statutes to include peace officers and firefighters participating in a defined benefit plan after June 30th, 2006. So that would be this new tier again. Section 13 is a conforming amendment to AS 39.35.160A, outlining the employee contribution rates for this new tiers and making an exception for the new tiers, saying the employee contribution rates for this new tier will not necessarily be the same as for those in existing defined benefit programs. Section 14 is the first one you will see on the slide. This is the section of the bill dealing with employee contribution. It creates a new subsection, AS 39.35.160A, setting the employee contribution rate for peace officers and firefighters participating in this new plan at 8% of the employee's compensation. It also allows the ARM board to adjust this compensation rate from 8 to 10% if the plan becomes underfunded. Section 15 amends AS 39.35.255A by referring to the new subsection I, and by doing so makes clear that the total employer contribution remains at 22% for peace officer and firefighter employers. Section 16 is a technical conforming change to accommodate the new subsection I. Section 17 is also a technical conforming change for this new subsection. Section 18 is the next one you will see on your screen. This is the section of the bill dealing with employer contribution and where the cost of the bill comes from. This adds two new subsections, I and J, to AS 39.35.255. New subsection I establishes one of the new features that aims to make the new tier financially viable. It specifies that the employer contribution to the employee retirement benefit will remain constant at 12%, and that the difference between the 12% contribution dedicated to the employee benefits and the 22% total employer contribution will be available for the past PERS system liabilities. New subsection J states that the ARM board may increase the employer contribution to the employee retirement benefit based on the board's decision to increase employee contributions. This is also a new feature that adds some certainty and financial viability to the plan. Section 19 amends AS 39.35.288 regarding employer contributions for medical benefits, conforming that section to changes from the new bill. Section 20 is a conforming amendment to AS 39.35.370A, which outlines the years of service requirement. Section 21 is the section that talks about the years of service requirement and retirement age, and you'll see this one on your screen. It amends AS 39.35.370 by adding a new subsection L, detailing the service requirements for peace officers and firefighters participating in the defined benefit plan after June 30th, 2006. Members are eligible for normal retirement benefits at age 55 with at least 20 years of credited service, or age 60 with at least 5 years of credited service. Section 22 is the new AS 39.35.537, that's the medical benefits again, are added to the list of plans that elected public officials are not entitled to under the alternative benefit for elected public officials. Section 23 is a conforming amendment to AS 39.35.475A, which concerns the schedule for making annual post-retirement pension adjustment payments and making exceptions to that, because we have the part of the bill where the PRPA can be paused. Section 24 is a conforming amendment to AS 39.35.475B concerning the calculation of the PRPA. Section 25 is having to do with the PRPA, and this was one you'll see on your screens. This section contains one of the new features added to keep the new tier viable. The section is intended to allow the ARM board to reduce a benefit the automatic post PRPA to keep the new tier viable. The proposed subsection G sets up the adjustment feature, and H allows the ARM board to reduce the payments if the unfunded liability is greater than 10% in the new plan. Section 26 is a conforming amendment concerning medical benefits for employees under the defined benefit retirement plan. Section 27 is a conforming amendment concerning major medical insurance coverage to those under the defined benefit plan. Section 28 amends AS 39.35.535 by adding a new subsection G, saying that peace officers and firefighters participating in the plan after 2006 are to receive benefits under the HRA as allowed in the new medical benefit section. Section 29 is this new medical benefit section I've been talking about a lot so far. This adds that new section 39.35.537, creating an HRA medical benefit for peace officers and firefighters first participating in a DB plan after June 30th, 2006. The section specifies the eligibility cost for premiums of major medical insurance and procedures for participation. Section 30 is the high five rule that Representative Josephson referred to earlier. It amends AS 39.35.6804, which contains the definitions for defined benefit retirement plan statutes, and adds a new paragraph F under the definition of average monthly compensation that states the calculation for peace officers and firefighters in this plan will be based on the high five consecutive payroll years during the employee's career. Section 31 is a conforming amendment to the definition of employer to include the new tier. Section 32 is a conforming amendment to the definition of normal retirement to include the new years of service requirement language. Section 33 is a conforming amendment regarding membership in the DC system, stating that all employees who become members after July 2006, except for the individuals who are in this new tier we would create, are part of a DC plan. Section 34 adds new subsection 39.35.750 regarding employer contributions to the defined contribution retirement plan, stating that those contribution requirements do not apply to individuals who are in this new defined benefit plan. So sections 35 and 36 you will see on your screen. These are uncodified sections of law that outline, 35 outlines the election procedures for how someone who is in tier four and in the public safety field can buy in to the new tier. And section 36 talks about how the department will create procedures to transfer funds from tier four to the new tier. Section 37 adds a new section to the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, instructing the Department of Administration Commissioner to make conforming regulations. Section 38 states that section 37 takes effect immediately. And section 39 is the effective date, and thank you for bearing with me on that.
Thank you, Ms. Sorenberg, for that sectional. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know there's a lot in this bill, and I've heard similar bills in previous legislatures. And there's a lot of detail and a lot of fine information. I guess, as someone who doesn't expose myself to this subject matter frequently, if I can get some sort of general overview, you mentioned solvency, 90%. If that, then certain things get triggered. Is there sort of a bigger picture? You know, the employee pays money in, the employer pays money in, it's held in a fund. As long as it earns enough money, it pays out to the recipients. I mean, I think that's generally how it works. And if this program were to start tomorrow, how soon would you need to start paying people out? 5 years, I mean, when would the first recipient be able to get a benefit, seeing as it's a brand new system? But I guess the solvency thing and what these triggers mean, and if now's not the time to answer these kinds of questions, I don't know what your exact plan are, but just to get an overview, that'd be great.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, we do have a presentation directly after me by the actuary, Flick Fornia, who helped with design of this plan, and he will go into the details of solvency and models he's run and that kind of thing. But I will say that only those who have basically been in the DC plan, so since 2006, could buy in. So if you started as a firefighter in 2006, say, you would have 14, 15 years of service at this point. And so you would need at least 5 more years before you would be able to retire under this plan, and you'd have to be 55. So the earliest this plan would start paying out, I would say, would be in 5 to 6 years.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. The big concern I had last year with this bill, and I continue to have, is that upside risk and how that upside risk is shared. The employee contribution rate is capped at 10%. Would that be correct? I think that's what on the slide above us on section 14, employee contribution rate may be increased up to 10%.
Through the chair, and that's correct.
Yes, and that decision would be made by the ARM board?
Through the chair, yes.
So the state would contribute 22% as its maximum contribution, but as we've learned from the current retirement system, there was an unfunded liability that needed to be filled. And I think Representative Josephson identified that dollar amount today as about $5 billion.
Through the chair, yes.
So how do we keep that from happening again? And I understand that adjustments have been made and protections are in place to keep that from happening again. But 30 years from now, we could have our predecessors, our successors, sitting here looking at an unfunded liability in this system. So how could we craft this program in such a way that the employee shared in some of the upside risk more than just a cap of 10%? Thank you.
Through the chair, I'll take a stab at that. The state's actuary, Mr. Kirchner, testified just 13 months ago, so, and this is the same bill, that he perceived this bill was 99.3% funded. He said, and I'm virtually quoting, that the plan does not add to the liability. It does not add to the existing liability. There is some, and in the early years, it's $3 and $4 million, cost associated with the state needing to contribute a bit more to other people's, it's all of ours, unfunded liability. In other words, it's not a cost directly associated with the new cohort we're trying to create. It's basically the employee is the proxy for the amount that goes to the unfunded liability. And the state will be contributing marginally more. But I would note that that $3 or $4 million, when you compare it to just the training and recruitment costs for the lost employees, gets swamped. So that's a factor. But it's true that in a defined benefit, the government takes the risk. But we think that this is very low risk. And you talked about the employee participation in the risk. That's identified in several things. No cost of living allowance, an adjustment which may be made to their own paychecks if the ARM board decides that that the performance isn't there, that it's beneath 90%. And similarly, a loss of the inflation adjuster, the PRPA, where the performance is less than 90%. So there are all these things. And then, of course, the other employee participation is it's just far less generous than tier one and two and three because you can't retire at any age once you've got your 20 years. Tier one, I don't think you even needed 20 years. And you don't have that health guarantee that we all enjoy and that active employees enjoy. So you're going to have this health reimbursable arrangement, and you're going to have to, you know, leverage that and make do with that. And, we concede that it's going to be difficult to do that if you've retired at a young age, especially because you've got to cover that to age 65.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the answer. And I guess my question, if it's was it 99.3% certainty of success, which is a pretty high percentage of success, so why the fear of structuring this in a way that the employee shares a little bit of that risk with the state if it's so certain to succeed?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the employee is already sharing that risk. The normal employee contribution is 8% in this plan. It would increase to 10% if it went under 90% funded.
And I won't get any further into the weeds here because we're just hearing this, and I know there's other bites of the apple, so I'll just make a comment that at some level that risk needs to be shared in a way that makes it easier for us collectively to get behind this and to give it the yes vote. And I can say in my closing comment is we were dealing with an $11 billion shortfall in the defined benefit tiers 1, 2, and 3. We closed that gap, not us maybe, but about 10 years ago that gap was closed by the governor and the legislature. We still have about a $5 billion gap. So we just have to make sure we set this up the correct way so that in another generation our successors are not dealing with a multi-billion dollar funding gap. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we could go to Section 25, and it speaks about the Armed Board being able to reduce pension payments to peace officers participating in the defined benefit if the plan has an unfunded liability greater than 10%. Can I use that percentage or the likelihood of that happening based on the number that you said previously, 99 point something percent? So the likelihood of that happening is less than 1% based on the testimony. Can you make that same equation?
Through the chair, yes, although we should note that stocks and bonds, for lack of a better term, are doing better than they're typically going to do. So now, having said that, when the testimony was offered at a March hearing last year that it was 99.3% solvent, March 4th, COVID had struck and the stock was performing miserably. So, I think that Mr. Fornia may be the best source to respond to that. But, I'm not going to say, it's a 1% chance that the 10% PERPA would be withdrawn. But it's unlikely.
Follow up?
I certainly appreciate the concerns of Representative LeBon, and we share those concerns. We don't want to have the state put in a position where they're in further jeopardy or there's a further unfunded liability that they're responsible for. But with that said, with the adjustments that have been made to this plan, and I think I'm correct in understanding, once the person retires and has a benefit determined, that benefit doesn't increase at all as the years move forward. It's just the same benefit year after year after year. Is that correct based on this plan?
Through the chair, no, because the PRPA is an inflation adjuster.
Oh, so there is an inflation adjustment aspect
correct.
To this.
Correct. But that's the thing that can be suspended.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Justison for bringing this bill forward. I think it's incredibly important. Do you know how many public safety employees we currently have in the state?
Through the chair, from a previous hearing and a whole lot of documents we have on this, I'm remembering the number 3,000. It might be closer to 4,000, but it's not more than that.
Yes, follow up. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Do you know how many state employees were covered under Tier 1, 2, and 3?
Through the chair, I do. Tier 1, 2, and 3 active members is about 12,000. Now, if you add the TERS, which was called Tier 1 and 2, they're not on their fourth tier, they're on their third tier presently. It's about 16,000. Active DB plans.
Yes, follow up?
Thank you. So I guess the other question I would have when we're looking at a previous $11 billion unfunded liability was, how many retirees under Tier 1, 2, and 3? I don't know if you have that information, but collectively, what was the state's obligation for anybody active or retired under Tiers 1, 2, or 3?
Well, I know that, through the chair, I know the first part, because I happen to have my handy sheet here, but retired Tiers 1, 2, and 3 is in the range of 47,000 people right now. Now this number is almost 2 years old, but it's not going to be substantially different, I don't think. But your second question was, can you repeat?
I can probably do the math, but it looks like you have 12,000 active employees, 16,000 TERS active employees, and 47,000 retired 2 years ago, so roughly 75-ish thousand people that contributed to the $11 billion unfunded liability, and we're talking about 3,400 people at present, correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. This is why I think this is where we pivot and turn the corner to a new defined benefit, because of the cost of recruiting and training these individuals, the fact that we're building these great employees who leave, and we can't blame them because they're shopping, and have to look after their families, et cetera, and because it's a small cohort, and because this plan is affordable and low risk.
Yes, follow up.
Last follow up statement, I guess. I think that with the low number of personnel and Representative LeBon's concerns, it seems to me that we would be able to find a slight compromise here that makes the rest of some of the members who are a little bit apprehensive about the level of risk the state would be incurring, but also recognizing that the number is substantially lower than the previous membership in the defined benefit, and I do feel like this is incredibly important. I'll save my closing remarks, but I'm hoping we can find something that will get everybody to a yes, because this is an incredibly important issue for our entire state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Next, we're going to move to some invited testimony. Mr. William Fornia is with the Pension Trustee Advisors to present an actuarial analysis. Welcome to House Finance, Mr. Fornia. If you could please place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm William Fornia. They refer to me as Flick. That's a nickname that I go by. I'm with Pension Trustee Advisors based in Colorado, and I'm working on behalf of the firefighters. And I can see I've got a couple second lag here. First of all, your technology is a lot better than it was 2 years ago, last time I testified with you all. I appreciate that. I can see that my presentation is up, so if the permission of the chair, I'll go ahead.
Yes, please.
So we've got this plan. Representative Josephson was calling it a defined benefit plan, but it's really more of a hybrid plan because it's not a pure defined benefit plan by any stretch of the imagination, and of course it's not a defined contribution plan like your current tier is. If we can go to slide two, I'll give you a little bit of background on me before I jump into the meat of my presentation. And so I started my firm. First of all, I'm a credentialed actuary. I'm a fully credentialed actuary. I'm not wearing a tie right now, unlike that picture. I've been in this business for over 40 years. I am currently the secretary treasurer of the Society of Actuaries. That was an elected position, elected board position, and then I was elected by the board. I've been written a few well-known pieces on DB and DC plans. I've frequently testified to legislatures and city councils. I'm pleased that I've been up to the Junos a few times to testify in front of you all. And then I've testified by phone a few times. I've also testified in Illinois, Kentucky, Rhode Island, Ohio, Nebraska, Colorado, Utah, Oklahoma, and New Mexico and North Dakota. And if we go to the next slide, I work for a variety of I don't work for labor all the time. In this case, I'm working for a coalition I historically worked for a coalition of public employees in Alaska. I'm now working for the firefighters. But my largest client, for example, is the state of Ohio, where I advise the state oversight board. Another project I'm currently working on is for the city of Austin, Texas. I'm helping the city in their negotiations with their police, firefighters, and other employees and pension issues. In the Detroit bankruptcy, I worked for the banks. So I need to play it straight because otherwise people will say this is what you told someone else. I was corporate actuary for Boeing for 4 years, about 40 years ago, and then I started my firm a little over 10 years ago. Just before I started my firm, I was hired by the ARM board. I was their first ongoing review actuary. And I did that for a couple of years before I changed firms. And then also I had the privilege of being in Juneau in 2009, in February, gorgeous day, and I presented my results of an audit of Alaska PERS and TRS. So I'm very familiar with your issues. I was also the head of the Buck Consultants Denver Retirement Practice, who after my time was your ongoing actuary. And then I've advised lots of groups since I founded the firm. Let's go to the next page. Let's get into the meat. I'll try to answer some of the questions that were asked, that I heard asked by Representative Wohl and Representative LeBon. And if it works, I'm happy to ask questions as we go along. Perhaps the technology makes it a little tricky, but I'll hope to cover those. Let's go on to the next page. Yeah, you're on it. Sorry. Why is change necessary? You heard that. It's because the current tier is not providing adequate benefits, and your workers are speaking with their feet. We'll go into that in a minute. Then I'll talk about the proposed structure, and again, I'll try to cover some of those issues. And then I've got some financial projections that show the likelihood of this being successful or not being successful. Mm-hmm. Next slide, please, which is the bar charts. So basically, under your Tier 3, which is the, tier for firefighters hired, police and firefighters hired just before 2005. I did some calculations for an average typical firefighter that had a final average pay of $80,000. They would be getting a benefit with a full career of a little over $45,000. But if they were in the Tier 4, that benefit would be substantially less because of two reasons primarily. One is their investment return is not likely to be as good as it is in as good as it is under a defined benefit program. And two, they don't know how long they're going to live, so they don't know how quickly to draw down that benefit. And then the third bar shows that even if they were just in Social Security, which they're not, But if they were, they'd have a benefit almost as good as that tier four. Let's go to the next slide, please. It's just some of the numbers that are behind this. So this typical person I showed you had 25 years of service. They retired at 56, hired at 31. And those numbers on the bar chart before was 57% of pay falls to 31% of pay. And so that's a reduction of 26% of pay. And what that means is they're running out of money in retirement. I understand that you had some testimony a year or so ago from Bob Mitchell, who did some work showing that some very similar results. And then also, this doesn't even cover medical. And this program is not changing the retiree health care program for people hired since 2005. They will have the same health care benefit they did before. And frankly, that's one of the reasons your plan has the higher unfunded liability is because it includes the health care program. Just this is kind of a sidebar, but most states do not offer retiree health care in their pension program. So when you compare an unfunded liability number of Alaska with an unfunded liability number of another state, they're probably not even counting their health care. That's done separately. You and Ohio are the only two major states that fund retiree health care through their pension program. Slide seven. So this is kind of a summary. You've got two broad types of programs. A DB plan is what Representative Josephson called an old school pension. And a DC program, defined contribution, can be thought of typically like as a 401k, which is the most common plan in the private sector. And what someone like me has, I'm self-employed, I'm saving for my own retirement. So the nice thing about DB plans is that because they pool the longevity risk, in other words, the DB plan has to pay over the life expectancy of the average employee. And by doing that, they know, and the one thing that the actuaries get really right on that is, how many people they expect to be alive next year, because that's a pretty easy thing to predict on a group basis. On an individual basis, it's not very hard to predict. In other words, my mother's 88. And she's saving for retirement, and I don't know if she's going to live one more year or she's going to live 12 more years. And so it's very hard for someone like that to plan on how long they have to pay themselves. Then DB plans also have a diversified portfolio. They can maintain a very well-diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds throughout the entire period, whereas like me, I'm 62. I'm retiring in a few years, so I'm starting to have to be more conservative in my investing. I can't be as aggressive, and so my expected returns are higher. And then, of course, DB plans are also just better managed. The people that the ARM board works with that invest those monies are a lot better than the average 401k type person would be, someone investing on their own. DC plans, however, are very consistent with the whole individual responsibility theme. Basically the employer pays a certain amount and then it's up to you, employee, to figure it out. And it's under the full control of them. It's very portable, which actually is kind of shooting you in the foot right now, because a firefighter or police officer can work 5 years in Alaska at the beginning of their career, have a pretty decent balance, and then they go down to my state, Colorado, or Washington State, or California, or Texas, and then they can buy into the new plan because they get the best of both worlds. They get this portable benefit early in their career, and then they get a guaranteed benefit late in their career. But then of course the advantage and the one that Representative LeBond pointed out is that there's no risk of an unfunded liability for this to the employer, and under a DB plan there's a real risk of an unfunded liability. You saw that with your what was an $11 billion unfunded liability a decade and a half ago. Well, what was been designed here was what we're calling a shared risk hybrid plan. It's basically has features of both DB and DC. It's got the cost effectiveness of the DB, those three hyphen points up top, but the actual risk, in other words, the risk of things not turning out as well as the actuary predicted, is borne by both the employer and the employee. And so, the two ways the employee is bearing the risk, in addition to agreeing to a lower benefit than tier three to begin with, you know, they have their contribution go from 8% to 10%. That's a 25% cost increase for them in their contribution. And then this post-retirement inflation adjustment, if they're not 90% funded, the ARM board can, and I hope they do, you know, suspend that post-retirement pension adjustment until they get better funded. You know, a lot of the plans around the country, they're going through changes right now. They're using the COLAs because it makes a lot of sense. You know, if the investments are terrible, it's pretty easy to suspend a cost of living adjustment compared to making other changes. If we can go to slide 8, I wish you would.
Mr. Fournier?
And yes.
I just wanted to note we have about 15 minutes left in this hearing.
Okay, I will wrap up in 5 then, so that the other parties can testify too. So slide 8. Make sure to hit the most high important points then, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you.
So you've got this fixed contribution, and then we're trying to manage a plan that covers that target as well as it can. You've got these adjustments. And I think those were adequately described before. Let me go to slide 9. The highlights here are the contributions would be about the same for employees to start with, but it might go up if they have to. The employer contributions are basically the same. Vesting's the same. Retirement age is a big change from any age to age 55. The benefit multiplier is essentially the same. And then the final pay, as Representative mentioned before, is about the same. I don't want to repeat what's already been said. So let's go to the next slide, please. Slide 10, I think we've covered that. The disability benefits are the same. Disability and death benefits are the same, which is a tiny little nuance. It was asked, how soon will there be money going out of this program? You know, in theory, if someone buys in and then they become disabled or die, then there could be some monies going out. So the plan will have a small outflow in the first few years. Slide 11, I think we've covered most of these. Yes. Little nuance, but when we designed this plan, we wanted to make sure it was going to be okay. So we used a more conservative assumed rate of return than the ARM board is currently using. That's kind of an actual technicality. Let's go to the next slide, please, slide 12. Current members can buy in other words, they can take their money from the old tier four and use it to purchase equivalent benefits, but they'll do it on a cost-neutral basis. So the plan will start out at 100% funded. The ARM board and their actuaries will calculate formulas to make sure that that's the case. I think I should skip through slide 13 and 14 because they're a little bit dense and just an example of how a pension works. The bottom line is it's a lower pension than the tier three. We've got these three safeguards in effect, and these are the ways that I believe this plan will have a low risk of being poorly funded. You've lowered the benefit. Slide 16 shows some cost estimates. This is kind of dense. If you don't mind, I'll just go through that. Slide 17 is key. We've got these margins. And so the plan is designed to be overfunded. You know, if things turn out the way we predict, you'll be more than 100% funded because you've got a little cushion. More money is going in than the actuary thinks is necessary. Slide 18 I've already discussed briefly. Let me jump ahead to slide 19. What we did is some simulations because I believe it was Representative LeBon that asked the likelihood of this becoming poorly funded. So what we did is we looked back over, I had data back to 1980. And so we looked at 20-year periods and said, what if we put this plan in effect and what would it look like 20 years later based on each like historical return, 1980 to 2000, 1981 to 2001. You know, I tried them all. And the worst case it was if this plan started right at the before the dot-com bubble burst, and then our first two or three years were the dot-com bubble bursting, and then by 2008, or, you know, 8 years in, we had this financial crisis. And, you know, so that was, as it turned out, to be the worst case. And the worst case for you, you had 8.6% average return. And if you look at the chart on page 20, this shows some simulations of, so, you know, under these three historical examples of what might have happened, the gray line is the worst case. So if you had started the plan in 2000, you know, you would have dipped close to 90% 3 years in, you know, because you'd had the dot-com bubble bursting. Then you would have gotten back up to 100%, and then you would, whammo, would have been gone down below 90% in year nine. So in 2009, you would have had to raise the employee contributions by 0.25%. You would have had to suspend the post-retirement pension adjustment. Of course, that wouldn't have done much because as Representative Wolf said, there wouldn't be a lot of people collecting benefits yet. But the contributions would have gone up. So the contributions would have gone up for a few years, and then they would have gone up again once you dip below. So they'd probably be close to the 10% by the end of the year 13. And then by now, that contribution increase would have been unwound because you would have been over 100% funded. Now, but this will be entirely up to the ARM board on how they do this. I kind of modeled a little scheme where they went up by 0.5% each time you dip below. But under the other scenarios, you know, that orange line is like the average scenario. So the average scenario is if you'd started it in 1995, you know, and then you would have been looking great in the first 5 years, and then you would have dipped down as this 2009, the Great Recession hit, and you know, you would have gotten close to 90%, but not quite, but you'd be back up to 100% by now. Now, the orange line, or maybe yellow, I can't tell, the top line, is one of the better cases. This is the, out of the 20 cases, this is like the 15th, or the fifth best out of 20. I mean, that one's fantastic. You would get up to 140% funded, and then you'd start to dip down. So in the real world, this will be somewhat volatile. You know, there is an excellent chance that you'll hit the 90% once in a while. But there's not much chance that you'll get much below that 90%. And if you did, and that's, I think, what I'm trying to show on slide 21. Or no, I'm sorry, I'm getting into that. But if you, under these bad scenarios, they're bad for everything. I mean, under these bad scenarios where you'd be less than 90% funded for a prolonged period of time, that would mean a substantial financial, that'd be Great Depression-type arrangements. We're running late on time, so I'm happy to go through what some other states are doing. Wisconsin is the best example. They've had a plan kind of like this for decades, and it worked really well right after the Great Recession. They did suspend some of their cost of living adjustments for a few years, but by now it's all back. South Dakota has done something similarly, but not quite as old. Those two plans are very, very well funded. Colorado and Ohio are not so well funded, and they have similar mechanisms in place to do this. So, you know, what's been done here is we're taking some of the good examples. I'm sorry, please go to one more slide down. Sorry. We're looking at some good examples of what various states have done. So why don't I take questions if you have some, and we can move forward to the other testimony. Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Forney. We have a question from Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Forney, I can ask you a lot of questions because I want to understand this really well, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to ask you one question. Under the concerns of unfunded liability, which seems to be the major concern with these kinds of plans, and this bill is only taking a small population of all the state employees, basically the public safety component, which is 3,000 or 4,000, which might be roughly 1/10 or a little less of the total state employees population. And as the Representative Josephson said on the outset, there is push, and many people would like to say, well, why not get all the public employees and teachers and so on? Using economy of scale, if you're going to have a loss, then you want to reduce the loss, so you go the smaller population. However, does the inverse work? You mentioned years where it's funded at 133%. If you had a larger population that you were that was under this plan, and things were north of 100%, would that economy of scale then add benefit? Would that be an advantageous position to be in? I understand you don't want to lose, and if you're losing with 3,000, you don't want to lose with 30,000 or 50,000. But does the inverse of that work, and is it beneficial? And I know we're not going to go there on this bill, and I'm not pushing for that. But I'm just saying, in general, if you're doing 133%, which was one of your graphs, would having more people in the pool be better?
Through the chair, Representative Wool. Yes, it's just as simple as you think. I guess I get nervous though, because one thing that I'm really don't want to have happen is for temporary euphoria to cause, you know, either a reduction in contributions or an increase in benefits, because as we've learned, markets really do go down as well as up. So there's nothing wrong with a plan that's 120% funded. You know, that's a very desirable position, and you know, just cross fingers that it stays at that level. But you're absolutely right, Representative, that the inverse is true. If this works well for this group, it would have worked just even better for a larger group.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. The program is identified as a shared risk hybrid retirement program for public safety. And that shared risk is the part that I'm still trying to grab my arms around. The shared risk is limited to the employee, but it's 100% the responsibility of the state. If the future doesn't pan out the way we hope it does, and at some future date, there's a unfunded liability. The question, I guess, is if the employee contribution rate is capped at 10%, why not move that up to 12% and share some more of that risk?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, that would be a reasonable approach. The thing is that we modeled it. The chances of it going up above 12% are just very, very remote. And I'd encourage the buck, if they want, the state's actuary, to do similar projections, because I guess it's possible. But if that were so bad, we would be, I mean, you know, first of all, your other unfunded liability, the $5 billion, would have probably gone back up to 15 or 20, because this takes really terrible returns to get to that position where we would want to, under the mechanisms we have, keep raising the members' contribution rate. I would suggest you just change the law. I mean, if 15 years from now we've had absolutely disastrous returns, then I think it's very reasonable to go back, change the law, say, hey, we'll take away the 12% cap or 10% cap. It's now a 12% cap. But I think we've designed it so that that's a very remote, unlikely event.
Follow up?
And you always do have the authority to change that law. You can't go back and cut benefits in most states, but you certainly can increase the employee's contribution.
Yes, thank you for that answer. And just one follow-up, Madam Chair. I guess I get nervous when I'm told not to worry about the future, that everything's going to be fine. And I would rather not count on our successors 15 years from now fixing something that we could fix here today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative LeBon. Representative Josephson, any closing comments?
No, I guess we don't have time to hear from our other invited guests.
At our next meeting, I've been in contact with Mr. Miranda from the Alaska Professional Firefighters, and we will hear his presentation at our next hearing.
Okay.
I want to make sure he has adequate time.
Sure.
We have floor this morning.
I guess the only thing I would say, and I think Mr. Fornia said this in a previous hearing on a previous bill, but I share Representative LeBon's concern with unfunded liabilities because they're an imposition on the next generation. But if the plan is overfunded, it's an imposition on this generation. And so theoretically, if you have 120% funded plan, then the employee isn't getting the benefit that they arguably, at least mathematically, would be entitled to. So, you know, I stand by the state's own actuary just a year ago saying this is 99.3% funded. And the employees actually will receive less pay if the ARM board thinks that their contribution rate needs to increase. They'll receive less pay if than a typical pensioner if the performance is poor, and so they'll suffer inflation and not have the inflation adjustment. So they do have skin in the game. And of course, the major way they have skin in the game is they have to hang in there until they're 55 with, frankly, and 65 on the health plan, with, frankly, inadequate health care, to be honest. And they're going to need a second job if they've retired in their 40s.
Thank you, Representative Josephson and Ms. Sorenberg. We'd like to also thank Mr. Fornia for being with us today. And this concludes our agenda for the morning. Our next meeting is this afternoon at 1:30, where we will hear House Bill 41, Shellfish Projects, Hatcheries Fees, House Bill 41, Council for Alaska Native Languages, and House Bill 127, Muni Bond Bank, UA Loan and Bond Limits. So with that, at 10:11, we are adjourned. Thank you.